Opening narration.
Akhotra Foundation presents the Akhotra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI.
Introduction.
Okay, so Sylvia Plath. When you think of her, one word usually comes up, right?
Tragic.
Tragic, yeah. It's that image, isn't it? The tortured poetess, brilliant but doomed. A literary martyr.
Exactly. And that's the myth, the cultural story that's kind of taken over for decades, really. It overshadows the, well, the actual working woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the focus is always on the emotional stuff, the end.
Right. And it misses the sheer brain power, the discipline behind the writing.
Absolutely. Intellectual muscle.
So today we're doing something different. This deep dive. It's about Plath the professional.
Mm-hmm.
Fiercely ambitious, incredibly disciplined, obsessed even with achievement, with literary immortality. We want to look past the myth, find the strategy.
And the key source helping us do that is Linda Wagner Martin's 1987 biography, Sylvia Plath, on biography.
Which was a huge deal when it came out. Oh, massive. Because it wasn't just, you know, another book. It felt like a political statement almost.
Why is that?
Well, it was the first major biography written totally without the Plaths. A state's okay. No authorization, no editing, no control from them. And the estate, as you know, was managed by Ted Hughes, her estranged husband.
Right. And that's critical because the estate had been, well, shaping the narrative for years.
Curating it, definitely. Right. So Wagner Martin's book was like an act of reclamation, trying to pull the real complex woman out from under that manufactured myth.
Okay.
Which lets us set out our mission for you, the listener. We're moving past the victim's story.
Yeah.
We're zeroing in on her intellect, that relentless professional drive, and the incredible conscious artistic control she had, especially over her most famous, most intense work.
Chronological journey.
Okay, so to understand that drive, we have to start early, right? The source begins there in Winthrop, Massachusetts. Her father, Otto.
Yes, Otto Plath, a German immigrant, professor of entomology, described as quite a stern figure, authoritative.
A big presence in her young life, definitely. Mm-hmm. And then the key event, the foundational trauma, as the biography calls it.
Right. Otto's death in 1940, she was only 8. He died from diabetic complications that went untreated.
Wagner Martin argues this wasn't just grief. It was, well, it left a huge psychological gap.
Exactly. A wound. It created the sort of obsession with a lost, idealized, but also kind of terrifying male figure. Unreachable.
A ghost she'd wrestle with in her poetry later on.
Definitely. But the pressure didn't stop there. It just shifted. Her mother, Aurelia.
Ah, yes, Aurelia.
Aurelia had her own academic dreams, which she'd put aside, so she poured everything, all her hopes, into Sylvia.
Creating what the source calls a suffocating expectation of perfection.
Mm-hmm. Sylvia felt she had to constantly achieve spectacularly to sort of justify her mother's sacrifices. Her self-worth got all tangled up in it.
Which led to the golden girl persona.
Precisely. The overachiever. First poem published at 8, winning all the awards, acing everything at Wellesley High, then Smith College.
It was like armor, wasn't it?
Yeah.
This relentless need for everyone to see her as perfect, validated by success.
A performance, really. And a brilliant one. But, you know, build a facade that high.
Bound to crack eventually.
Which brings us to Smith College and that drive. She was on scholarship, pushing herself incredibly hard.
Then comes 1953, the summer guest editorship at Mademoiselle magazine in New York. Should have been amazing.
The absolute peak, you'd think. Her dream. But it turned out to be, well, shattering.
Yeah, the biography really paints a picture of how overwhelming it was, the reality of that sophisticated literary world.
It wasn't what she expected. It was commercial, competitive, maybe a bit shallow.
And it just exposed that gap, didn't it, between the perfect image she projected and the vulnerable person underneath.
Totally. Led to a severe mental breakdown, hospitalization,
right,
and then that awful experience with electroshock therapy, the botched ECT.
Which she wrote about so searingly in The Bell Jar.
Mm-hmm. The source calls it confronting the doppelganger, that shadow self she'd kept hidden under the Golden Girl mask, losing control when control was everything to her.
But here's the thing. The myth often glosses over her resilience.
Incredible resilience. She didn't just collapse. She fought her way back.
Returned to Smith, graduated summa cum laude in 55,
mm-hmm.
and then immediately won a Fulbright to Cambridge.
It wasn't just getting better. It was like defiance. Using her intellect, her ambition as fuel to get out of that darkness, choosing academic success as her way forward.
Which takes her to Cambridge. And it's Ted Hughes in 1956. That meeting. It's legendary.
Oh, absolutely. Electric, intense, almost violent, wasn't it?
Yeah, the story is he tears off her headband, she bites his cheek, hard enough to draw blood.
Wow. Talk about foreshadowing. Competitive, passionate, destructive, maybe?
Their relationship was this intense literary partnership, though. He was already a rising star.
And he really pushed her, didn't he? Encouraged her to drop the more polite, formal style she'd been using.
Yeah, to tap into something more primal. Nature, the subconscious. Explore the darker stuff.
He definitely helped her find that mature voice, that raw power.
But then, 1962. The marriage falls apart. Hughes has an affair.
And here's the paradox Wagner Martin points out. This utter personal devastation.
The collapse of the perfect wife-mother facade.
Was actually the catalyst for her artistic liberation.
How so?
Well, the need to keep up appearances was gone. She was free from his direct influence, maybe free from those constricting 1950s expectations of femininity. And her real voice, that fierce, uncompromising voice, just erupted.
Which leads to that incredible burst of creativity in autumn 1962, the Ariel poems.
Yes, that furious pre-dawn burst, writing poems like Daddy, Lady Lazarus, Ariel, stuff that just burns off the page.
People often think of it just raw emotion pouring out, uncontrolled.
But the biography argues strongly against that. Wagner Martin insists it was a period of supreme artistic control, conscious craft.
She was taking that personal agony, that rage, and shaping it.
Exactly, turning it into universal archetypes, using all her skill, her intellect, to forge these poems. This was her securing that literary immortality she always wanted. She was working.
Masterpieces created, legacy secured, but at such a cost. The final months. That brutal London winter of 62-63.
Yeah, deep depression, isolation, leading to her suicide in February 1963. A tragically short career, but incredibly impactful.
Core philosophy and values.
So let's try to pull together the core tension here. Wagner Martin really emphasizes this duality in Plath.
Absolutely, this constant battle. On one hand, she genuinely seemed to long for that conventional 1950s life, the wife, the mother, the domestic setup.
But on the other hand, this absolutely ferocious ambition, the drive for literary greatness, for recognition, for immortality.
And she tried to conquer both worlds at the same time, which created this immense internal friction, like living two competing lives.
So what was the primary driver, according to the source? Was it the domestic dream or the literary one?
The biography is pretty clear. The professional ambition was paramount. She was driven by this relentless need for literary immortality. And also, crucially, financial independence. She didn't see writing as just self-expression. It was a career, a way to make her mark and support herself.
Which brings us to probably the single best piece of evidence for that professional mindset.
Ah, you mean the index cards.
The meticulous index cards. Tell us about those.
It's such a telling detail, isn't it? Plath kept these detailed cards for every single piece she wrote, poems, stories.
Tracking everything.
Everything. Date sent out, which magazine or publisher, what the response was, accepted, rejected, paid.
That's not the behavior of some chaotic, purely emotional artist waiting for lightning to strike. That's strategy.
It's discipline. It's treating writing like a business, managing submissions, tracking markets. It's incredibly professional.
So her approach to difficulty, the suffering, it wasn't just passive endurance.
No, not at all. Her method, as the source puts it, was to transmute suffering into fuel.
To take the bad stuff and turn it into art.
Exactly. Consume the adversity, process it, and make it into literary capital. Powerful, but...
Three pivotal turning points.
Okay, let's pinpoint three moments, three turning points that really shifted the trajectory of her life and work based on this biography. First one has to be her father's death, right?
Absolutely. Otto's death in 1940 when she was 8. We talked about it setting up that psychological wound, that obsession with the lost father figure. It resonates through so much of her later work, especially Ariel. It's the foundational event.
Creating that ghost she constantly grappled with. Okay, second turning point.
I'd say the breakdown in 1953, that summer at Mademoiselle.
The shattering of the Golden Girl persona.
Precisely. It was the collision between the idealized self she'd built and the messy, overwhelming reality. The hospitalization, the ECT. It forced that confrontation with the doppelganger, the hidden self.
And importantly, her survival and defiant return to academic success after that. It showed her resilience, but also maybe deepened her reliance on achievement as a defense.
Possibly. It certainly proved her immense willpower. But yeah, it was a terrifying ordeal that shaped the bell jar and her understanding of mental fragility. Okay, third turning point.
It has to be the separation from Hughes in 1962.
Agreed. The collapse of the marriage, the affair. Wagner-Martin argues this personal crisis was paradoxically the moment of her greatest artistic breakthrough.
The liberation point.
Yes. Freed from maintaining that domestic facade, freed from his direct influence, she unleashes that final, powerful voice. It leads directly to the Ariel poems, her most enduring legacy. Personal devastation becoming artistic triumph. A really complex, difficult turning point.
Human lessons and reflection.
So, looking at this life, this professional drive, wrestling with personal demons, what are the human lessons here? What resonates for us today?
Well, one thing that really stands out is the danger of that perfectionist persona.
The golden girl.
Exactly. We see echoes of it everywhere today, don't we? Especially with, like, social media, this pressure to project a flawless, curated image of success,
right?
And happiness.
Yeah. Constant performance.
And Plath's story, particularly the breakdown after the Mademoiselle summer, shows the potential psychological cost. The damage that can happen when there's this huge gap between the curated self and the authentic, inevitably flawed inner self.
It's isolating, isn't it? Trying to maintain that perfection.
Terribly. And her life is a stark reminder of that pressure, particularly perhaps for women expected to excel in multiple demanding roles simultaneously. That friction she felt between being the perfect wife, mother, and the ambitious great writer, that's still a very real tension for many people.
Yeah, the attempt to have it all and be perfect at all of it.
And her method of using suffering as fuel, while it produced incredible art, the biography suggests it was ultimately corrosive.
Unsustainable.
Right. It raises questions about the relationship between creativity and suffering, and whether channeling pain into art always comes at such a high personal price. It's not necessarily romantic. It can be destructive.
Three final takeaways.
Okay, let's distill this down. If someone takes away three key things from this deep dive into Wagner-Martin's perspective on Plath, what should they be?
All right. First, an emotional insight. I'd call it the bell jar within the bell jar. Her life just vividly shows the terror when your own mind feels like it's betraying you. That stark contrast between the high-achieving outward appearance.
The golden girl.
And the internal reality of depression, fragmentation, that private struggle. It's a powerful look at mental illness from the inside.
Okay. Second, an intellectual insight.
The architect of Ariel. We really need to understand that her greatest work wasn't just, you know, an uncontrolled emotional outburst.
Not just a scream.
No. It was an act of supreme artistic and intellectual control. She was consciously, skillfully crafting that rage and grief into complex, universal poetry. She was a master architect of her own legacy in that period.
Got it. And finally, a universal insight. Something practical for everyone.
I think it's the critical cost of the perfectionist persona. Her story is such a potent reminder that talent, genius, ambition, none of it makes you immune to psychological suffering.
Right.
The relentless drive for that flawless image, in her case, contributed to immense internal pressure. It really underscores how vital it is to destigmatize mental health struggles and acknowledge that vulnerability and strength often exist side by side.
Final provocative thought in closing.
That leads us to a really challenging final thought for you, the listener. Something to chew on.
Mm-hmm. Given Plath's undeniable ability to, as we've said, kind of weaponize her experiences to craft literary immortality.
Yeah.
Does transforming profound personal trauma into that kind of lasting power, does it almost require an emotional or psychological toll that is ultimately unsustainable? Can you really survive feeding your art with your own lifeblood at that intensity?
A heavy question. Can that kind of creative alchemy exist without consuming the alchemist? It's something to think about. We really encourage you to read Ariel or The Bell Jar if you haven't, and definitely check out Linda Wagner-Martin's biography. Engage with the brilliant, complex, professional artist behind the tragic myth.
Closing narration.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.